Right, everybody. Hello. It's time for podcast series 3, episode 2. Linux Voice Podcast, that is. I always just say that, podcast.
As if there's only one podcast in the whole
world.
Yeah,
exactly. But that's like when you send your CV to a company if you're applying for a job and you just call it CV, you know, dot text.
Are you trying to tell us something, Andrew?
They're getting loads of CVs. Or when people write to me and send me something that's just called invoice.pdf. Like, that's just useless, come on.
Yeah, we have these things called file names that have been around since, I don't know, the 60s.
So on that mega positive note, let's begin. It's the Linux Voice Podcast, Series 3, Episode 2. We're going round the table in alphabetical order, but I'm going to start because I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Ben Everard.
Does M come before S?
I'm going. I thought we're going with
forenames, aren't we?
Oh no!
Cancel the podcast.
Okay, well, I'm Graham Morrison. I'm Graham,
and I'm Michael Saunders.
Wonderful. And in this Fun Pack podcast, we have some news. We have a halfway reminder that will probably come about 2/3 of the way through the podcast. Finds of the fortnight. We may or may not have some neurons to read out, and we'll end it all with Voice of the Masses. If you like the sound of that, but rather than in a podcast form, in some sort of magazine-based confection that you can take away and read at your leisure, you can get that, and that's Linux Voice, the magazine. We're available in Easons in Ireland and lots of other places around the world.
And issue 12 is out today.
Is it? Oh, that's fantastic.
It is in the UK, yeah.
A full year of awesome win, and if you subscribe, you get all the access to all the back issues as DRM-free PDFs.
We think we worked that out. It's about 1,260 pages of back issue content you
get
if you
words.
Subscribe.
Yeah.
1 million words, yeah.
How many Lord of the Rings is that?
It's about half.
in the welcome page for issue 12, I looked into our web email server stats, and we've sent over 60,000 emails, which isn't perhaps surprising when you think that includes subscription emails. But between us, we've received 30,000 emails in that 12 months.
Wow, 30,000 emails.
Yeah.
A lot of them will be like PR bits and bobs, but
I've got 114 unread at the moment.
I think there's a creation of a religion around email, kind of what you do with it. Because I have an important folder that just gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and then my conscience gets the better of me. Usually when I'm travelling without internet access, and I look at my important folder, and it's just a lot of it's become so old that I just delete it.
Could you not have a subfolder inside that, like really important? Yeah. This is top important, mega important.
I hate email. I hate it. I know it's essential, but... So I'm sorry.
Enough of this nonsense. Let's get on with the news.
Right, the news. Well, the top story this fortnight is the Ghost vulnerability. It's a fairly significant security issue in glibc or glibc. In the get host by name function, so this can be remotely triggered. Basically, anything that makes your computer do a DNS lookup could potentially be used. It's a buffer overflow, so it can be used to execute code. So it's pretty serious and remotely triggerable.
Just for a second, can we pretend to be proper journalists and include a couple of words or phrase to say what glibc is?
glibc is GNU's C library, so it's basically used by just about every bit of software on your Linux system.
Right, because C is the language that the Linux kernel is written in, isn't it?
Yes.
So it's mega important.
It's mega important. And yeah, as I say, it's in the get host by name function, which is used when you do host name lookups. And they can be triggered from anything from, some SSH authentication stuff, some web server stuff. It's pretty easy to trigger this if you want to.
Now, here's a question, and this might be going back to the basics of buffer overflows here, but when you overflow the data stored inside a buffer, that is going to be in the data section of the executable, isn't it? Like the BSS section or whatever. You can't then execute that.
It's been a while since I've actually executed a buffer overflow, and it's not as easy as it used to be because of the way address spaces are handled in Linux, but it is still possible.
Yeah, and like you say, this routine is used a lot, isn't it?
Yeah, there's actually a really good paper on it by someone who calls himself Elf1, Elf0, I forget, something like that, called, I'm trying to remember the name of it, I think it's Smashing the Stack for Fun and Profit.
Oh, I remember hearing about that, yeah.
You overflow the buffer, but you chuck in quite a large amount of code, most of which is no ops. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of it, you have your shell code. So you just have to land the executable pointer somewhere in that massive no-op slide. And I forget exactly how you do that.
Yeah, I think there are things like write or execute, aren't they? So that some pages of RAM, you can either execute them or you can use them as data, but you know they can't do the same thing. So.
Yeah, and by using the no-op slide, you don't have to position it exactly right.
I see. Yeah, you can have a few thousand of those, and then at some point the you jump into that roughly that area.
Yeah.
So how big is this vulnerability? Is it up there with Shellshock and what with the Heartbleed and stuff, do you think?
So compared to Heartbleed, that was an information disclosure vulnerability, which is obviously serious because you can lose certificates and that sort of thing, but you can't actually, it couldn't be used to compromise the machine. Shellshock was really serious because it was both incredibly easy to perform and it was a code execution and often gave root, sometimes gave root. So that was pretty massive. This is somewhere between the two, I'd say, because in many ways it's similar to Shellshock in that you can get you can execute code, but it is harder to trigger. We haven't seen the thousands of web apps and tools and whatnot for doing it, although it's certainly executable if you know what you're doing and you want to do it.
Do you think, have they found out yet if this bug has been in glibc for like the past 10 years or something?
Well, there's a bit of a controversy about this because it was fixed, I think, a year or two ago, but it wasn't, but it wasn't marked as a security fix, so it wasn't backported.
So some older distributions using previous versions of glibc, yeah, they received like super critical security updates, but not little piddling bug fixes, yeah.
Exactly. So the classic secure stable distros didn't get this fix. So, you know, your Red Hats, your Debian stables, etc., etc.
Yeah. Ooh, that hurts then. Yeah.
Yeah. If you are running any servers and you haven't yet, make sure you update glibc and obviously restart all services as well so they pick up the new library.
It's interesting, isn't it? The sort of pattern that has emerged from these vulnerabilities in the last year, that they're always in code that people don't really want to work with. You know, glibc, OpenSSL and stuff. They're not cool, trendy, sexy pieces of software. They're just sort of infrastructure code. And nobody really wants to hack away on that. You can't show off your awesome skills, unless you're Ulrich Drepper. But
I think there's a certain amount of that, but it's also a certain amount of those are just the ones that get publicity. I mean, at the same time, I mean, I haven't looked at the stats, but I'm sure there's been a good dozen or two dozen WordPress, and there's a massive Drupal vulnerability as well. And
true.
They just don't get the publicity of the old ones.
Yeah, that's true.
Also, after watching that, was it Super Mario World, Mike, where they used an exploit in the by placing sprites in specific memory locations and constructing a level in such a way that it executed arbitrary code to get a really fast speed run. When people are prepared to put so much effort and spend so much time mastering such an obscure exploit, I don't see how any piece of code is going to stand any chance. ever.
Exactly. Yeah, you look at that video. Let's put a link in the podcast notes to a guy getting to the Super Mario World end sequence by placing objects in specific places, and it's like, yeah, that is very obscure vulnerability, and that guy isn't getting anything from it apart from massive kudos amongst retro gamers. But and then if you think about things like that, if you can come up with a similar exploit in Glibc OpenSSL and sell it to the Russian mafia for 20k, then
yeah,
boom.
Yeah.
I think you'll get a lot more than 20k for this.
Oh, right, okay. Now that I know, I think I'll quit my job here and become a black.
But actually, I believe this one was found automatically by a security scanner.
Yeah.
And there's been more work using things like fuzzers and source code analysis tools in recent years to harden
code. Was it found recently by security scanner when it had already been fixed, you know, whatever it was a year ago?
Good question. I can't remember.
And also, is there a way of finding out whether you've been exploited or anyone done anything with it?
Just the usual methods, really. Right. Any strange activity on your server, anything weird in your history, that sort of thing. If that's a particular concern, that's what IDSs are for, intrusion detection systems.
And another good reason to put log files on a different machine.
Yeah. Although, of course, if they're nice binary log files, they'll be much harder to hide things in.
Ooh. All right, then.
Can we have our money now, please? Moving on to some slightly happier news. Dell have released two new Linux laptops. The updated XPS 13, which I believe is being known as the XPS 13 2015 edition, and the M3800 Mobile Workstation Developer Edition, which is sort of like a super high-powered, fancy, all-singing-all-dancing laptop.
Yeah, it's bigger, isn't it? Is it 15 inches?
Yeah, it's bigger. There's a lot of options to it. It can have up to a 4K display. You can have a terabyte SSD if you want, and you've got nothing better to spend £1,000 on.
£1, cheaper than a Mac, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's just the SSD, sorry. All sorts of, 16 gig of top-end RAM and all this sorts of stuff. If you want a big, chunky machine that runs everything super quickly. The XPS 13 is a smaller, lighter weight machine, but still quite high spec.
So you can get both of these with Linux pre-installed, yeah?
Yes.
Because... Graham, you had the earlier XPS 13 to review, didn't you?
There's been two updates to the XPS 13. Yeah, in fact, I looked at the second update to the XPS 13 in issue 2, which is now CC by SA.
Right, of course, yeah.
Yeah, and they come with Ubuntu's developer tools and with Ubuntu installed, and they used to come with an Ubuntu repository configured for its own packages. I think Canonical helped development of the touchpad driver and things like that. The XPS 13 is a great little ultrabook because it's small and light and it's got a high-res display and it's got a full-fat CPU.
And pretty decent battery life, doesn't it?
Yeah,
well,
yeah, that's right. I think it was like 6.5 hours or 7 hours and it felt great.
I remember looking at it just, from looking physically from when I was at your house once, and it did seem like quite a nice machine. I mean, we need more laptops bundled with Linux out the box in the Linux world, because it can be such a nightmare trying to get Linux to work, as we all know.
I've been in touch with, in fact, Barton George is the guy that created Project Sputnik, which is, Barton George works for Dell, and so he's the Dell side of the Canonical interface, of the Dell interface to Canonical. And so he put it all together, and he's going to try and get us one of the new models anyway, so that'll be interesting. But yeah, Dell providing Linux laptops is great, considering they're part owned by Microsoft now.
Well, you remember they had the Dell Mini 9 or something netbook quite a few years ago.
Yeah.
I remember in my previous life as a different journalist, trying to get hold of one of these machines with Linux pre-installed, and then Dell just wouldn't even listen to you. So it's nice that they've changed their attitude somewhat.
What I find quite interesting about these is they're labeling the Linux version as the developer edition.
Mm.
I can't decide if I like this or not. It gives a sort of reason to it. It's not just it's Linux, you know, and that's sort of supposed to explain why you would want it. Although I'm not, at the same time, I'm not sure I like the feeling that Ubuntu is only good for developers and everyone else should use Windows.
Yeah.
I think the meaning behind that's been lost in that initially it was to do with Ubuntu's cloud development stuff. You know, when they were, I can't remember what it's called, right? You know, the way that you can kind of, it's become Ubuntu Core and Ubuntu Snappy Core, but the laptop was created so that people could create web apps and deploy them from their Dell hardware, and that was the developer side of it. They were trying to cash in on the cloud thing rather than making it like let's run Eclipse and build apps. But yeah, that subtlety's been lost by just calling it developer edition.
Yeah, and I also think that this is actually a much closer to a standard Ubuntu build.
Right.
Okay, next up on this fortnight's Linux news, it's Bodhi Linux returns. Jeff Hoogland, the maintainer behind the project, retired a few months ago, saying he, you know, other things had come up in his life and he could no longer devote the time to it. He's since had a change of heart and he's come back. He's announced Bodhi 3.0.0. There's a release candidate out. And what's quite interesting is they're developing, or they've got running, a web-based app center. So as well as having, obviously, your command line tools, I think it's apt-get, I think it's Debian-based. You can go onto their website and they've got a sort of software center type thing, and you can click on links to install apps and all that sort of thing.
Mm. So Bodhi is like Enlightenment. It uses Enlightenment as its default desktop. Am I right?
Yes. Yeah.
It looks really cool.
I'm always a bit, I don't know if I like the look of it.
It looks better than it works, I think. Like, I give it a go and think, wow, this is amazing, this is the future, and then just get really irritated when I can't find that off switch or, you know, file menu or something.
I remember a few versions ago, they used to, by default, they'd have falling penguins on the screen that would land on top of your windows and walk around. At least I've got rid of that now. Cool. It's so annoying.
I remember something similar back in the 90s. You could get X snow, and it would snow on, and the snow would settle and build up on the top of all your windows. Those were the good old days.
Could you build it into little snowmen by rolling it along the top of the window to make a big ball?
I don't think you could interact with it. They should. I should update the code or something. And
maybe that's there for Wayland snow.
Were you going to mention the release of Plasma 5.2?
I wasn't planning on mentioning that release.
I thought you might mention it, so I actually installed it yesterday, because the last couple of times you've mentioned a KD release, I hadn't actually bothered installing it. But I was just going to mention that it breaks my Arch. But it's not.
Have you read the wiki?
It's not. Arch never breaks, Graham.
It's not Plasma's fault, and it's also my fault for running Arch on a Mac. It's the 3.18 kernel and the Broadcom wireless Ethernet and the wireless driver creates kernel panic. It's a horrible, horrible problem. It happens quicker when X is running, but it still happens from the command line. It took me ages to sort it out last night. But the very latest DKMS package from the AUR fixes the problem. So and Plasma 5.2 is really, really good. It's excellent. If it hadn't become corrupted by my kernel panic and having to go through all the configuration files, finding which one's creating the problem, it would have been seamless.
It's interesting. I can't recall having all these problems with Zubuntu.
So how close is Plasma 5 getting to sort of general readiness for usual users?
I think it's ready now. I mean, the thing is that 90% of the apps are still KDE 4. But for the last couple of months, you've been able to run KDE base 4 stuff alongside Plasma 5.2. So they both work together and there's really no problem. So for example, KMix, the audio mixer that brings sound control to the desktop, needs to be from the 4 base. But with each new release, there's more and more stuff that's 5.2 native, things like the console or the file manager. So it works well. Most people won't know, apart from it looks really good.
Does the Qt4 stuff look okay on KDE5, or does it seem out of place?
No, it all looks fine. I think it looks just the same. It's not really a capabilities thing, although performance is supposed to be much better with the Qt5 base, but it's more to do with their new design. So all the widgets and stuff are vectors. The new panel is all based on vectors, and they've got lots of new high-res icons for stuff. So it's more that than an actual technical functional upgrade, although in the background, almost all of the libraries have changed and the APIs have changed.
So does that mean it'll look much better on the 4K screen on the Dell M3800 Mobile wow. Workstation Developer Edition?
I didn't realise it was a 4K screen.
That's not the standard screen, but you can get it with a 4K screen.
Well, yes, it will. So I'm running on the 13-inch Mac that I've got, and it looks fantastic, but it doesn't look fantastic by default because KDE, and still as far as I can tell, almost everything but Ubuntu, has no idea that you're running a high DPI screen, which I think is a huge problem for Linux. And it means going manually, either setting the DPI in X, going through and changing all the fonts and making them massive, which has all kinds of knock-on side effects if you're using bitmap images for buttons. And so it takes a lot of effort to actually get it looking good in a high DPI screen, but it can be done. So it will look good in Plasma, but it not by default.
Is that because KDE never looks good by default?
Ooh. Burn.
Maybe. It gives you the tools. It's an artist's canvas.
So that's all we can say about Bodhi Linux. Moving on to our final item of news this fortnight. The LibreOffice has released a beta version for Android. At the moment, this is just a viewer, although hopefully there's more to come on that. And they've said that, it's a beta release, and it's a fairly beta release. Writer has received the most attention, so that should be the most solid and stable and work properly. Calc is a bit iffy from what I hear, and so is it, I've forgotten actually the name of the presentation.
Impress.
I thought there already was OpenOffice on phones, or is it iPhone or Windows Phone that I've got confused with?
There might be an iOS version of LibreOffice. I know someone was working on an iOS version, although I don't keep too up to date with when stuff gets released because I don't have an iOS device. There's Microsoft Office for Android.
Fair enough, that'll be it.
And there is actually a proprietary build of OpenOffice for Android as well. Mm. I forget the name of it. But this is the first sort of proper open source office suite dingy for Android.
Okay, cool. So you just need to upgrade the RAM in your phone and get a new CPU for it. And it'll run like a breeze.
I would imagine this is targeting tablets more than phones. I haven't actually installed it. I really should.
Does it still need Java?
But that, you mean like Android needs Java?
Like Android needs Java. Okay, yeah. It's great. It's a big development. But yeah, I mean, I fall into the. I don't use an Office suite. It's just I have no need to. You know, don't know. I know how they work. I know what they do. But yeah,
I still find word processors just the most bizarre thing. They like LibreOffice Writer or Microsoft Word, they've got so many design elements in them, but they're sort of like a really bad layout tool.
Yeah.
And I think they're quite bad at actual text processing. Things like Vim and Emacs are better for that.
And I really like Focuswriter, you know, just writing. I suppose that's what I'm looking for, is a writing tool. I'm not looking for something to automatically insert today's date underneath the correctly formatted address and tell me how I should be addressing the person that I'm writing to. And leave space for my signature.
I can see, you know, lots of you know, affluent, aspirational couples up and down the land, relaxing on a cream-coloured sofa, holding a tablet, you know, doing some really boring spreadsheet while they were while they watching Take Me Out. That's what I'd do if
you weren't busy.
Yeah,
make a spreadsheet of all the people on Take Me Out.
In fact, it's on. There was a tutorial in an earlier Linux Voice that I do all of our kind of grocery budget shopping in a Google spreadsheet, and then that sends an automated email to us telling us how much we've got left to spend each week. I just added forms to its spreadsheet input, so you no longer have to open up the spreadsheet. You can create a very simple form which will automatically add new rows to it. So you don't even have to open up a spreadsheet anymore. It's really good. But then all your data goes to Google.
Yeah, Eric Schmidt knows exactly how many eggs you eat every week.
Bottles of wine is what I worry about.
Have you been buying them with Bitcoin so the supermarket doesn't know who you are?
No, but I have been. I've been watching the prices since you mentioned that they were getting quite low, and it's so tempting.
We as a company have about £50 in Bitcoin since someone renewed their subscription. And we could have cashed out straight away, but we thought we'd hold on to it. I don't know how anyone can hold money in Bitcoin. We've got £50. And the amount we've had can vary by like £20 overnight. And if you had even, you know, a few hundred or £1,000 in Bitcoin, just to see, wake up in the morning and see you've got 20 or 30% more money than you, or less money than you had the night before, I'd have a heart attack. I don't know how that would work with your budgeting spreadsheet, Graham.
Oh no!
Can you bring? Can you use JSON imports of data? Can you get it to get the live feed?
Yeah, probably. It all sounds like it's becoming quantum accounting to me, though. You know, you don't actually look at the values in a cell, because as soon as you look at the values in the cell, the value gets wrong. I've got some specs for the Ubuntu phone, you know, in their drip feeding PR campaign, which I think the launch is just in a week tomorrow. The specs are...
Oh, yeah, Don't eat before you go, because their burgers are amazing.
I haven't booked the train yet or anything. I daren't look into it. So it's a 4.5-inch screen, with a resolution of 960 by 540, 5-megapixel fixed focus camera, and 13-megapixel autofocus. Okay, so 5-megapixel at the front, 13 at the back. Dual flash, dual micro SIM. That's interesting. A 2150 milliamps battery, a quad core A7 running at 1.3 gigahertz, 1 gig of RAM. So it's quite a modest hardware specification. So I'm guessing the price is going to be quite reasonable or cheap.
Does the dual SIM card thing suggest that you'll be able to dual boot it easily?
I think it...
No, that's an entirely separate thing. Yeah. That allows you to go on two networks at the same time.
It's great if you travel. Ah.
Okay. Yeah. You were thinking of SD cards, Andrew, I think.
Yes, I am. They look pretty much the same,
yeah,
don't they?
Yeah.
So if you're like Mike, if you're an international man of mystery and you're in Germany 1 minute and in England the next, you can just flick a switch and...
Yeah.
You know, you don't need to have two phones.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it used to make a huge difference when the prices were so different. But, I mean, the prices are still different now, but it's no longer... It's something like 19 pence a minute rather than the £5 a minute that it used to be.
It's quite common in a lot of countries where you get minutes just to one network, or it costs a lot, much... The per minute rate is very different depending on which network you're calling. So... Yeah, you have different SIMs, and you can get incoming calls from both, and it works quite well, usually, although I've never actually used it on Android. I mean, it's not that modest, the hardware. I mean, quad-core A7s running at 1.3 gig is a fairly hearty amount of processing power for a phone.
It sounds really, really powerful to me, but I don't have a high-end smartphone. So.
Well, there's the display 960 by 540. That's pretty low.
Yeah.
Like bigger than anything I used for the first like 25 years of my life.
Yeah. But I'm just
shut up, granddad.
That's 1.5 TVs next to each other, crammed into a tiny little phone.
Yeah, but I've got used to the high resolution in displays. It's like, well, I mean, my Nexus 5. What is the resolution of that? It's like, it's huge. in fact, it's 1920 by 1080. Yeah, and that's got a 2.26 quad core CPU in it, and there are lots coming out with octa core.
Yeah, it's true. You can constantly cram more stuff in, but do you need it?
Yeah.
I suppose if you're running LibreOffice, you might.
I have a question. Is this Ubuntu phone then? A while back, they talked about it being like your use anywhere device. On the go, you can do, you know, bits and bobs, emails and things, and then you can plug it into a docking station or, you know, into a monitor and a keyboard, and then you've got a full PC. Is that the way they're going with it?
I haven't read anything about that, no.
The convergence. Some sort of idea they came up with ages ago, wasn't it?
Was that Ubuntu for Android?
It was their Edge phone kind of touted those features, didn't it?
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking of, probably.
It did. Convergence.
As far as I'm aware, Mir will have the ability to switch between windowed and phone mode, but I'm not 100% sure this hardware supports output to a monitor. Did you say it had a micro HDMI or anything like that?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't say. I literally read out the entire specification list that they've sent.
Yeah.
There are pictures here, but they don't show any connectors.
They spoke about this, I think, on the Ubuntu UK podcast, I think it was. And I've forgotten what they said.
They're much more likely to know.
Yeah. And that's our news for the fortnight.
Brilliant. I'm not even going to look at the time, the number of minutes we've got in. But it was all good stuff. So moving on to finds of the fortnight. I did ask the IRC channel again, but there was a complaint about the amount of food talk that we had last time. So I'll try and cut the... I'm just trying to open up the right page now for it. Quadlibit, which I've never heard of, but he says it sucks less than Rhythmbox and Banshee.
I've just reviewed that for Fospix in issue 13.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Is it new? Or is it just something that's been under the radar?
I think it's just something that's been under the radar. It's sort of key feature is it's got quite a powerful search interface. It's for text-based searching, but you can create all these sort of crazy query strings to build up your playlists based on just about any aspect of the song. You know, its tags, its length, its genre, its artists, all that sort of thing. So if you think, I want to build a playlist of, I don't know, 3.5 to 4 minute rock songs released in 1968, you can do that. Yeah. And why wouldn't you?
Absolutely. He's also got another great find, which was, I didn't know this, apparently to get your picture in the login session of a login manager, he doesn't say which one, you put a 96 by 96 pixel PNG image in your home folder and call it .face. That's interesting, because there's probably different ways of doing it. If there's a standard way, if that's important to you, I don't even run one.
That sounds like the sort of thing that should be standard.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? Yeah. But those kind of standards predated graphical login managers. And then he's also got, for keyboard-centric anti-mouse fanatics, Conqueror, C-O-N-K-E-R-O-R, is a web browser based around the Zool Runner engine and that Firefox uses, but with Emacs-like navigation.
Right, because if you're going to make a new web browser, that's what you'd call it, Conqueror.
Yeah.
Yeah, naming it, make it sound almost exactly the same as another similar program. What are people thinking? But
with a C rather than the K, Mike.
Yeah, Mike, duh.
Didn't you used to use a web browser with VI key bindings, Mike?
I've tried a few of them. I think I reviewed one in Fospix when I had the pleasure of doing that section. There are some good ones, and yeah, when you get used to using them, you can browse way, way more quickly. But I'm not sure if it's actually good for RSI, because I think it's better sometimes to mess around with the trackpad and just have your hands in slightly different positions.
And that's it. There's a bit of a joke one, which was I'd not read before, but it's an RFC 1149. This is from the 1st of April 1990, but it's a standard for the transmission of IP datagrams on avian carriers. So that's data by a pigeon.
Probably faster than Comcast in the States.
Presumably it's UDP only.
We'll never know.
Yeah.
And they're the discoveries from the IRC channel. Oh, there was something about Marmite, but I can't remember what it was now. I'm sorry, whoever sent that to me. Let's see if it was here. Oh, I've got rid of it. It was in my draft folder.
It wasn't in your important folder, Graham.
No.
Oh.
No, it's in my draft folder. That says it all, doesn't it? Important emails I save as drafts. I haven't really got anything specific. Shamefully, I've been using Windows 10 to play Elite Dangerous. I'm sorry. I had a copy of Elite Windows 10. I didn't spend any money on it, so I installed it. In fact, I installed it for our cover feature. I installed Windows 8 for our cover feature a few issues ago, and so that's what led me down this path. But anyway, the thing is that I built a little infrared LED frame for tracking my head movements to move around the cockpit so that I can look at the screen. And all the software for doing that is open source. And while I'm doing it in Windows, the software runs on Linux. It's called Open Tracker, and Linux Track is the thing that interprets the axes of the three infrared LEDs and turns them into movement. So I'm going to look into getting something similar working on Linux. People use it's a cheap PlayStation 3 camera. It costs £3 on eBay, and you take out the infrared filter and you just get three LEDs. It's really cheap and simple to put together. People use them for making touch surfaces. So there's quite a lot of potential in that as a kind of a hack.
So if David Braben finally pulls his thumb out and ports Elite Dangerous to Linux...
Yeah, well, that's what I'm telling myself he'll do, you know, to appease my conscience. But,
I mean, if the guy can write 260,000 lines of assembly language to create the universe, then surely he should be able to just port Elite Dangerous to Linux.
I know.
You just need a new make file, right?
And well, there's going to be an OS X version, so I think he already said it's going to be more complicated than making the OS X version, and I don't know if Linux is carrying on the momentum for Linux game development is strong, but it would be such a good thing to see. And my other find is I do happen to use Evernote and Google Keep quite a bit for like making notes that are always on, and even though I've not used it, there's a Paperworks is an open source equivalent to Evernote, so it allows you to make notes in a browser, but more importantly it's got an open API that you can use for building your own apps and plugging it into other things, so you could have an app on your Android phone and open it up in a browser, which I find really useful with Google Keep, but Google Keep is itself an awful interface. So they're my two finds. Anyone else want to have a go?
I've got a find. Or a discovery, either or. So, games and that. A lot of them, some of them have some sort of trading element. Elite Dangerous being a good example of this. So, in the game, there is an economy. There's liquidity and there's inflation and there's arbitrage and there's, you know, all sorts of other concepts. And a while ago, I don't actually remember when, but I think it was a pretty cool sound that Valve are taking the mechanics of these things really seriously. They have an in-house economist. So when I don't play games, so I've got no, I can't really think of any examples. But like, say EVE Online, say there's a recession in EVE Online, you know, what do you do then? You know, if people aren't trading or people can't be bothered to do bounty hunting, then there should be a mechanism to raise the price of bounty hunting, I imagine. We need Simon Pigstock, because he was our old EVE Online expert.
Is this anything to do with the Greek economy?
It is the Greek economy, yeah. The new finance minister for Greece used to work for Valve in this role.
Oh, I shouldn't laugh, really.
But that's absolutely perfect. So, you know, normally, I mean, the economics is a really like lame science, because they can't do experiments. They've got really incomplete data sets. It's rubbish. They've had to invent a fake Nobel Prize to make themselves feel better about themselves. No, they all predict one thing, and something else happens, and then they stroke their chin and go, "Oh well, clearly it was because of this that we never mentioned at the time." So this
didn't
fellow,
you do economics, Andrew?
I did, yeah, I did for a bit. So this chap, Yanis Varoufakis is his name. He used to be the Valve economist, so he used to have like a universe where every single metric, every single piece of data was available to him. And that strikes me as being, you know, excellent training for real life. You know, why shouldn't it be? Mm-hmm. You know, we give kids, you know, Super Mario Brothers 3 to help, you know, expand their minds and teach them that exploring is good. You know, and here's this dude who's been in control of, you know, galactic scale economies, probably bigger economies than Greece.
Aren't all economies bigger than Greece?
Well, exactly so. So that's my discovery there. You know, so, and you know, people will still sit and say, you know, games are a waste of time, but it didn't do me any harm.
Well, let's see what position the Greek economy's in another 5 years. If he's completely trashed it by then,
they'll all be riding around in panther clippers. they'll take back the Elgin marbles by force.
So basically, Andrew, what you're saying is there should be a sim Eurozone.
Sim, yeah.
Why not? I want to play as Angela Merkel.
Oh. That's my find anyway, there you go.
That's a good find.
I've got a couple of finds, shall I go next? Mm-hmm. The first find is that somewhere on the other side of the world, where they walk upside down and ride kangaroos and whatnot, there's a Linux conference. In fact, I believe it's just next to where they ride kangaroos. linux.conf.au. They've got a really cool set of talks, and they're all been put on YouTube now, so you can go online and watch them. And a couple that I've really enjoyed, these are both ridiculously geeky, is Eric Anholt's talk on Raspberry GL, or OpenGL on the Raspberry Pi. He's doing... I'm going to try and make developing a graphics driver sound interesting now, so bear with me. Basically, you've got the video core for graphics driver on the Raspberry Pi, which is an OpenGL ES, which is kind of like a stripped-down version of OpenGL. And it's also got a bit of a weird driver. So he's trying to develop a port of Mesa, which is a standard desktop OpenGL system for the Raspberry Pi. So potentially, and the stuff on the Raspberry Pi, like, you can't run OpenGL in Windows. It sort of just takes over a chunk of the screen and everything else just disappears behind it. And that's because it's lacking things like EGL. And hopefully that will then come over, so you have nice windowed OpenGL. And also, hopefully, be able to run full OpenGL, the full version on the Raspberry Pi. So that would pretty much mean any Linux 3D program would run, although possibly appallingly slowly, it would run.
It reminds me of trying to get OpenGL working on my Amiga, which I did. I remember doing. It was like on one of those S3 Verge cyber graphics cards, which just had the most woeful OpenGL implementation. And I can remember rendering a chair in real time, but that's about one frame every 5 seconds. Sorry.
The second talk that I found quite interesting was, I forget who it was by, but it was on Dala, the codec being developed by Firefox and some other people. So it's designed to be a completely sort of open, as in unencumbered by patents, video codec that also performs really well. And it's quite interesting because they talk about how they've sort of sidestepped the patent problems and all that sort of thing.
Mm.
But there's also, which I found really interesting, there's a full JavaScript implementation of the video codec that actually runs on my computer.
Wow.
Yeah, so just in pure JavaScript, so you don't need anything installed, and you can actually watch a video in it.
Well, does it use the canvas tag, canvas element or something?
I don't actually know what its output is. I would imagine it's canvas, but it could be using something else. I don't know.
That's such a good thing for the Mozilla Foundation to be doing. I really admire that. I think it's, I guess they're just doing it, you know, in an isolated room, you know, so that they don't see anything of any other codecs. But
well, no, what they're doing is trying to take a different route. So there's basically, video codecs haven't fundamentally changed in about 20 years. They're still using the same basic methods, but just sort of tweaking them slightly. Which is, there's many things that really annoy me about the patent system, but the video codecs is ridiculous because there's no innovation going on. They're just fine tuning pre-existing codecs. Well, there's a bit of innovation, but there's not much. And they're just getting these patents, and they're extracting ridiculous amounts of money. I mean, the amount of money that flows through things like MPEG-LA, the licensing authority, is phenomenal. But they're doing very little good work. And you can see in the effects that it's having on HTML5 video, it's just stupid. These are problems we shouldn't be having. These are entirely man-made, and they're just messing with technology for profit when they're contributing very little, frankly. But anyway, this goes all the way around all of it. And the fact that you've got things like a JavaScript implementation that's, and they said it's not very optimized at the moment, they expect to get it better. But that would mean that you've got a fallback, so it would run in every browser or every modern-ish browser, even if it didn't have the codecs installed and all that sort of thing. But I forget what the point was when I started that rant.
The good talks at linuxconf.au.
Yes. So, have a look at those on YouTube. And the second discovery is the Budgie desktop. This is one created by Ikey Doherty for Revolve OS. And it looks really good. The best way I can describe it is it's sort of like taken the good bits of Unity and GNOME 3 and sort of put them on in, it's not quite a traditional layout, it's not quite not a traditional layout, it's somewhere between the two. It's one of those things that GTK3 for me has always seemed like it almost works, but not quite in a sort of graphical layout way, whereas this is the first time that I've actually thought, you know what, GTK3 is really good. And
that sounds really interesting. They sound like brilliant finds, actually. Really good. I really want to try it.
It's in beta at the moment, so you know, don't expect a polished system just yet. But and they said they're developing it with not to try and keep it on Evolve OS, but to have it so it should be fairly straightforward to package up for the distros, which is good.
Excellent. Thanks, Ben.
So, okay. I guess that leaves me then. Oh, well, never mind. I discovered at the weekend, well, actually last week, that Lille is really quite a nice French town. And that's Lille and not Lyon. Everybody thinks I've been to Lyon when I've been talking to them over the weekend. But I had no idea about Lille. But the French government basically paid me to go up there and attend a cybersecurity conference. For some reason, maybe they've just injected me with polonium or something, I don't know. but it was kind of interesting. I got to meet Bruce Schneier and have a quick chat with him.
I've always wanted to meet Bruce. Yeah.
I was supposed to have like a proper half an hour with him, but he was delayed coming out of America because his passport was invalid. Your passport needs to be have at least 3 months left on it to get into France. So he said they refused him at the gate in the States, and then he somehow managed to get a new passport done in like within like 8 hours or something and get it sent to him so he could get a later flight and arrive there. But
does he look like Chuck Norris?
Maybe now that you mention it, yeah. I should have asked him loads of Chuck Norris related questions. Like, when you roundhouse kicked that guy.
I think I'm thinking of a long time ago, but I'm sure there was something, there was some kind of Bruce Schneier Chuck Norris meme.
Could well be. But anyway, yeah, Lille is very pretty, lots of cobbled streets, an old town. Yeah. And more in Linux related.
Yeah, there is. Sorry. Schneierfacts.com.
What are some examples, Graham?
Okay. Hold on. Okay, next fact. That was a bit too difficult. All infinite sets are countable, Bruce Schneier. If Bruce Schneier ruled the world, it would be a cipher place.
All right. That sounds like something to spend half an hour browsing through.
Sorry.
That's all right. My second find was actually sent to me by Simon Hornbacher in Upper Austria. Good skill, Simon. He said, I recently found VCSH, which is basically a Git wrapper that allows you to have several Git repositories in one directory. I'm starting to use it to keep my dot files inside my home directory within a Git repo. Ideally, one day I'll have a Git repo for all ZSH files, for tmux, and so on. This is pretty cool. I've seen quite a few people do this, especially when they've got like quite complicated Vim setups. They store it, you know, their whole Vim profile and plugins and stuff on GitHub. So whenever they go to a new computer, you know, you simply just do a Git checkout and you get all your config files. You don't need to, you know, save them in your attached to an email or stuff like that. So, yep, there we go. And yeah, I'm just going to make it quick because time's running out. So.
Awesome. Thanks, Mike. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, IRC.
Good finds, everybody. Great finds. So now that we're an hour in, it's probably time for the halfway reminder. Still to come, we may or may not have some neurons, and we definitely do have the voice of the masses.
Okay, to make it quick, there are no neurons. I repeat, there are no neurons.
Super. Let's move on to voice of the masses, in which we asked, what's your oldest machine running Linux? Oh, that's the typo there. That was like a voice-o. Linus Torvalds has just rejected a patch that removes EISA support from the kernel, despite that technology being ancient by computing standards. Torvalds' reasoning is that it's not like it hurts us or is in any way fundamentally broken. So why not? Why not just let us have this really old thing still chugging away in the kernel? Old stuff. So what's your oldest bit of hardware you've got that still runs Linux? The consensus on linuxvoice.com is that about 1997 to early 2000s is the most common time period for having old stuff. Steve Rosenberg has got a 1999-era Compaq 7770 DMT laptop with a Pentium 2 MMX.
MMX.
233 megahertz with a 3 gig hard drive. Wow, that's awesome.
That's pretty good to me.
Greg Ramney comes in at 2004, which is just like yesterday, man. Our internal file server at work is a 2004 Dell desktop running Ubuntu. For what we need, it works just fine.
Sounds like her old job.
It does, doesn't it? What were they running? Is it Warty Warthog?
We'd better not tell anyone. As I suspect they're still running it.
Okay, it's definitely yes. We'll move on. We won't say because we don't know.
No. I'm sure they've upgraded it since then.
Yeah. John is running a Zubuntu 12.04 LTS on his Shuttle SK41G from 2002. It's Athlon Juron 2600 running on 1.5 gig of memory. That's Chris A has got one from 2003. Torwag. Hiya, Torwag. 1997, he says. Not exactly mine. However, in one lab, they operate cell culture equipment. It comes with a large controller unit to control temperature, pH value, gas steering, liquids, and provides a graphical user interface. They are more than 12 years old, and then he clarifies later on, 1997, and I once noticed that they run a 2.4 kernel.
Wow.
Les W gets the award for being the coolest because he's got an IBM NetVista from 2003 in the garage for playing music to work out to. It handles Thin Lizzy and Led Zeppelin videos full screen with no problem.
Surely it just has Eye of the Tiger.
Wow.
If it handles Thin Lizzy and Led Zeppelin, it presumably handles like Lily Allen and One Direction as well. The Triggers Broom Award goes to Tony. He has a desktop from 1998 that still gets occasional use, though it did get a new motherboard, processor and memory in 2002. It's really the latest Debian with LXDE with no problems, though it is rather noisy compared to modern computers. Let's pause, let's hold that noisy thought and put the question to the podcasters. What's the oldest bit of hardware that we've got, any of us has got?
I can't compete. Sorry, Ben. Carry on.
I say for me, it's probably the laptop I'm recording this on that you can probably hear the noisy fan in the background. I don't actually know where it's from. I got it second hand, but it's got a Windows Vista sticker, so it's not that old. Probably 2008 or so.
Yeah, I've got like a QNAP NAS that I've had for 6 years that's still running. But I haven't really got anything that ancient. You've just reminded me, my PC case that's under the desk here is probably 12 years old. But everything in it has changed. It's, in fact, when I bought it, I put in a load of like plasma tubes that shone neon colours and a load of neon LEDs and fans and everything. It was about that time. It's got like a glass side. And all of those bits have broken, and so the plexiglass has all got all misty, and the lights don't work, and the fans don't work, but it still works. The PC inside still works. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't have that much here either because I've moved around a lot in the last few years. So a lot of the old, proper old computers I've got, like the old Acorn 7000, in England in storage. So I'd love to get some of those running. I don't know what I'd do with them, actually, because they often suck up so much electricity.
Yeah.
As well. My brother brought from London some giant ancient IBM box that, you know, you could probably get running as some sort of file server or play Game Boy games on or something. But, you know, just use a Raspberry Pi for that, I think, and cut 99% off your electricity bill.
Well, yes, on that very point, Andrew Conway, hiya, Andrew, says... my main problem with old hardware is that it's power hungry and can be noisy. My old EPC from 2008 is not that old, but after being retired from desktop use, it's been on 24/7 for 3 years, serving up two websites, OwnCloud, TTRS, DNS Mask, and most recently doing music duties with MPD, all from behind the sitting room TV. It's running CentOS 6 and needs hardly any maintenance. Go GNU Linux.
Yeah, I think old netbooks are good stuff like that, because they tend to be quiet.
I use my NC10, Samsung NC10, which is probably from a year later than that.
And then Greg Ramey says, truth, I have a collection of several old computers that could be put to use for all sorts of things, but the fact that they burn through more electricity compared to a new, low-power, inexpensive computer, such as a Raspberry Pi, an NUC, or some other low-power device, prevents me from ever using them again.
Yeah, if we were talking about a collection of old computers, that's a different thing, because I've got quite a few.
What you've got? Don't you just buy them for the sound chips, though?
I did buy a load of Commodore 64s for the sound chips, yeah, but I've got an Apple II with a hard drive.
Does it boot?
It did the last time. I used to work in a video shop, you know, video cassettes in the 80s, and when the video shop closed down, I inherited the computer in lieu of not being paid for the last couple of months. So it's still actually got a snapshot of all video rentals that were on that day
In
like 1989 or whatever date it was, which is, I've not touched it. It's probably a real digital privacy nightmare if I was ever to turn it on.
It reminds me, at Christmas, I was at my parents' place and I dug out the old ZX Spectrum 128 plus 2 that I had.
Wow.
I got loads of Spectrum tapes that are unlabeled. So I just was messing around loading them up. And I loaded up one program and it was, it said copyright 1991, Dave Saunders, my brother. And it was something he wrote in 1991 when he was 14. And funnily enough, it was a German language practice program. It didn't work. I don't know why he bothered even doing it. He must have been doing German GCSEs at school. But it's just to think that, you know, that tape hasn't been touched probably for, what is that, 24 years?
Yeah.
And it just works. It just loads up and works. So interesting to see how much our current machines will be working that well in 24 years.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, I have very little old stuff. Mainly because I tend to buy stuff when it's old anyway, or when it's like low spec. I'll just go for the second cheapest machine in the shop. So I had one from about 2004 that had like 512 megs of RAM, and then I just stopped using it because it couldn't handle KDE on an emulator.
That's so crazy, isn't it?
So it was useless to me. Yeah, I'm sure it'll still boot now, but
512 megabytes is loads. That's 512 copies of Frontier running at the same time.
It should be enough to bring up a desktop, shouldn't it? But yeah. It was bringing up two desktops because it was running in VMware. Oh, but, you know, hey, never mind. Yeah, I guess if you have older stuff than that, if you have anything from the 80s, then, you know, why would Linux run on it anyway?
Yeah,
Linux is only from 1991.
I think, obviously, Linux has been made to work on some of that older hardware. It'd be quite interesting to try it. I've also got an Apricot PC from the 80s with like a membrane LCD display on the keyboard, which is pretty cool.
Wow, that sounds pretty awesome. Yeah. I know that the OpenBSD guys still compile the operating system for completely ridiculous, ancient, obscure VAXes and stuff. And I think nobody uses it, but their justification is it helps us to find bugs in the software. You know, just security holes and things by compiling for really obscure and old architectures.
Interesting discussion.
Yeah, I totally take the point of the people who say there's just no point running it on old stuff because, I mean, you could just replace it with a Raspberry Pi if you're just using it for a file server, and then you're instantly 30 quid down. Because you've bought something new, but then how long would it take you to save 30 quid worth of electricity? Probably not long. There's a graph in there, I'm sure. There's a really cool graph with lots of different colours.
Yeah.
We need an economist.
I thought you were going to say Bruce Schneier.
or Bruce Schneier. I'm sure Bruce Schneier would do an excellent job.
And also it gets kind of swamped in nostalgia as well. I think the question is about proper useful hardware that's still running rather than, you know, being able to boot up an Amiga again and stick Amiga and Linux on it.
Actually, I did see in one of the links.conf.au talks about stripping stuff out of the kernel to make the smallest possible bootable watch, because that's actually becoming important again with the Internet of Things stuff. And there used to be a project called Micro Linux. I don't know if it still runs, but it's stuck on like 2.6 kernel because then they introduced stuff and it didn't work.
System D?
Yeah. And so again, it's becoming important to, okay, it's not obscure hardware, but it's much low-powered hardware and small executables and that sort of thing. It's becoming important again.
Mm-hmm.
Tell you what is good for smallest beautiful stuff, Assembler.
Yes.
And if you want to learn more about Assembler, then Linux Voice is a good place to start, because we're starting a tutorial series on Assembler, aren't we, Mike?
We have from issue 12 onwards.
Which is on sale now in the UK.
It's brilliant.
It's brilliant.
that gets you started with assembly language on top of Linux. But as the tutorial series progresses, we're going to go more and more down to bare metal hardware. And basically, it's the sort of thing you can tell people at the pub. Like, I don't even program on an operating system. Just watch as the people just like bow down to it.
Mike
walk
is now
out of the pub,
rocking backwards and forwards on his chair.
I said that to somebody at Odd Camp, and I do know who it is, but I'll protect the name to protect the innocent. I said, oh, you know, Mike's written his own operating system, and he looked at you and then said, oh, he's a lot cleverer than he looks.
It's all true.
Do you have a keyboard with just two keys, 1 and 0? There's no bootloader, you just turn it on and tap away.
Sometimes I think I saw a number 2. Yeah, that was a bad day.
Right, excellent voices there, Masses. Well done, Masses. Thanks for your insight. And again, it's just so lovely to not have rage like most of the internet has. There's a comment here. I've not actually written down who said it, which is so annoying because I've done that for every other comment. I installed Lubuntu 14.04 a day after it came out on the oldest desktop machine around the house with 386 meg of RAM and an 800 megahertz Pentium, on which it runs smoothly. By the way, I had a chance to chat with Linus recently and the subject of running Linux on old hardware came up. He was less excited about it and said that he enjoys seeing it run on modern nice machines like the ones he uses more. Side comment, I just read Linus's answer and whoa, that was unexpected. It was not rude, to the point, and reflected a clear interaction and listening to other people. Perhaps the reporting on statements by Linus does not reflect his overall behaviour.
Well, that's it, yeah, but people always talk about when Linus mouths off on the mailing list, which he occasionally does, but that's like 1% of his total output.
Yeah, but
nobody reports about 99% of just technical messages.
Wasn't he pretty bad at LinuxConf in Australia as well?
I haven't actually seen that video, but I have heard that it didn't go down too well with some people.
That insight was from Peter. Thanks, Peter.
A guy called Daniel Ross back has written a conference report for us for issue 13. So hopefully he'll cover that.
Speaking of conferences, we should mention, in case we haven't already, that Ben and I are going to FOSDEM in Brussels this weekend.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we'll be walking around. So if anybody wants to buy us some nice Belgian beer, you know, we won't complain. We won't say no.
You should wear your Linux Voice branded T-shirts. So
I will do. I think I should check whether it's actually washed then. I don't know where it is.
Oh, Mike. Where is your mum? Okay, cool. That's it then, isn't it?
Yeah, that's all the weather.
Thanks, everyone.
Great stuff.
Yeah, have a good time in Belgium, you guys, over the weekend. And thanks to everyone for listening. And we'll speak to you again in 2 weeks.
Yeah, see you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye. Ciao.
Bye.